MGM UA home video coming attraction.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Tighten your jeans, practice your spin kicks, and watch for falling polar bears, junkies. It's time for another episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host. He is not only a screenwriter, not only a novelist, not only a lieutenant of Megaforce, but one of the best damn coolers in the business. He's Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And yeah.
We're joined this week by one of my good, super close friends.
Sam Elliott, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Wait. You just got so many people excited. We said this is going to be such a letdown, and I hate to say that.
Letdowns don't hurt.
No. This is a good friend of mine. He was a film critic way back in the day on Ain't It Cool News. He did film and television under the name of B-Man.
In the aughts,
the early aughts, the days when I came in to Ain't It Cool News, you were already a seasoned Ain't It Cool News vet. It's my friend, Derek Marr.
Hello.
And tonight.
I don't know what else to say.
Hello is fine. I just say hi.
Hello is fine.
We just kind of go.
All the way.
You listen to podcasts. You know how this fucking works. He's from Des Moines, Iowa.
Ooh, Des Moines. What's that like?
The buckle on the breadbasket.
It's like being in the movie The Puppet Masters all the time.
That's horrifying.
It's the only movie that was ever shot there. No.
Okay. I was like, that's a really specific... Like, you had a prepared answer, and I appreciate that. But if you would like to hear more prepared and unprepared material, you can always check out our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, consider...
Like the show.
Like it so much, it straps your testicles to your chest because your jeans are so tight. Seriously, there's a lot of tight jeans in this week's movie. We're going to get to that in just a minute. You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Make a pledge for every episode, no matter how much the amount is. You will get access to bonus content, which includes not only a weekly episode of some type that Cargill and I do, but of course the new taste test where I am watching movies that you guys send me, apparently because you don't like me very much, judging by the caliber of movies that I've had to sit through. But that cinematic Rochambeau, the taste test, is still going on. So both of those bonus content shows every week just for being a patron. We really do appreciate it. Well, pain may not hurt, but that's a terrible segue because
pain don't hurt, but
neither does watching this week's movie, which I am not only am I super excited that we're talking about this movie this week, I'm depressed that we haven't covered this movie already, that it took us nigh 3 years to get to this movie, Roadhouse.
Patrick Swayze is
Dalton.
I thought you'd be bigger.
Opinions vary.
When he's around, anything can happen.
How's a guy like you end up a bouncer?
Just lucky, I guess.
And usually does.
If somebody gets in your face, I want you to be nice.
Don't be rude.
Ask him to walk, but be nice.
Help this gentleman to the door.
Until it's time to not be nice.
So says the fighting philosopher.
He's not what you'd expect.
I thought you'd be bigger.
But there's one thing you can count on. He's the best friend a good time ever had. Patrick Swayze.
For that line of work, I thought you'd be bigger.
Gee, I've never heard that before.
Roadhouse.
It's a movie so good. Like I was discussing with you guys earlier, it really is one of those movies that feels like it should have a theme song with its title in the name. Like the fact that we don't have this bluesy rock anthem that's like Roadhouse.
You know we're going right down there. And then harmonica like jumps in. And there is the Jeff Healey band playing throughout this whole movie and reminding us subtly how good Stevie Ray Vaughan is. So that's really... What? Just because the guy's blind, I have to love his music because it sounds like just knockoff Stevie Ray Vaughan.
These are things that are not untrue. that said, you know, because the thing is, you know what Roadhouse is for the late 80s?
The greatest movie of its era?
Yeah, it's our Smokey and the Bandit of the late 80s. Like, I mean, it, like right down to having a musician in the, that's why I want a Smokey and the Bandit. I want an Eastbound and Down. Like, I want,
oh,
that
you want that
Roadhouse
song. Yeah.
I want that kind. I want that. Cause when you hear Eastbound and Down, you get that Smokey and the Bandit feeling in your gut.
Yeah.
And Roadhouse is a movie that is so good, so entertaining, so cheesy at times that it needs a theme song all its own. It just doesn't have one.
And the closest it had was Angel Eyes.
Actually, the closest it had was doing a cover of The Doors' Going to the Roadhouse. So strap yourselves in. We're going to the Roadhouse, and we're going to have a real good time. I love this movie so much. And if you're not familiar with it, this is a movie where Patrick Swayze kicks some sense into everyone in a small town.
Yes, he knows undescribed, non-specific martial art.
Martial art.
He just knows just, martial art.
He knows a guy named Marshall Arthur Sledwell.
He knows art, whatever yeah. martial art that Riggs knows in Lethal Weapon.
How is Sam Elliott not...
Tai Chi martial arts.
Yeah, and which he doesn't use all that often. Like, there's not really a lot of martial art in this movie.
How has Sam Elliott not played a character named Martial Art? Like a Western where his name is like Arthur Sledwell and he's the marshal of a small town.
Is in this movie, though.
Martial art.
The thing, I'm fascinated by this movie because this movie falls into such a weird period in history where Hollywood was experimenting with something and ended up creating something I don't think it gets credit for. This is a redneck feminist film.
Ooh.
It is a bizarre redneck feminist film that
Twitter
is,
swords are coming out. I like it.
That is at the same time a Top Gun knockoff.
It's so oily. It's so macho that it actually is like is super oily. And but you're right. There are some feminist bends to it for sure. But of course we're talking about the story of Dalton, who introduces the audience to an entire subculture of bouncering that we were never aware of. I think most of us thought a cooler was either a place to store beer or a William H. Macy movie we hadn't seen. But apparently, it's like a whole other thing.
The Cooler's actually a really good movie.
It is a good movie. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying no one saw it. It's a good movie, folks. Track it down. But we're, of course, talking about Roadhouse, where Patrick Swayze plays the greatest cooler of all time. Now, the cooler is kind of...
I know who you are.
I thought you'd be bigger! Oh, okay. Well, I'm not. That's what she said. The thing is, he is like the head bouncer. Like a cooler is kind of the chief of the bouncers. The guy who comes in when the bouncers have like need backup. This is who they call. And at the beginning of the movie, we see him being a bouncer at some dive place in God knows where. And he's actually scouted. He's recruited to come to Jasper...
Missouri. Is it Missouri? It's Missouri.
Missouri, to a place called the Double Deuce, which is the kind of place, as they describe, that as the owner himself describes, used to be a nice place, but now it's the kind of place where they sweep up the eyeballs after close. So it paints quite a picture. But he's recruited to come down there and basically help clean the place up. And so he does, and he spouts a lot of Zen, and he rips someone's throat out. Happy ending credits.
With his bare hand.
With his bare fucking hands. Like, again, like I don't disagree with you that there are feminist elements to this movie in the only way that the 80s could deliver those elements.
Well, that's what fascinates me about this movie is not that, you know, it's not a misandrist movie at all. It's a very macho movie, but it's a macho movie that within the subtext of the movie, it's what's so weird about it is Top Gun was such a huge hit. You know, just before this, and Hollywood was like, how can we make something like Top Gun? Something that is very macho, but brings the women in as well. Like, how can we make this soft sex symbol?
Show Patrick Swayze's buns.
They do that.
There is a lot of long, loving camera work just following his oily, chiseled
one of the
body.
Finest crafted asses in cinema history. Let's just throw that out there.
There is like, as there, much buns as a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie.
That's the ass that every man in America wishes he had. And the movie is all about showing it to you more than it's about showing you the film's sex symbol, you know, the female lead. Like, they're like, oh, yeah, no, she has a butt too. But did you see Patrick Swayze's ass?
You know what? They do show his ass a lot, and they photograph it in such a way that if the camera were any lower, this movie would be called Chode House. So I'm just saying, watch that camera work, guys. Be careful.
But no,
be nice.
The thing is that they were trying to create a movie that would be one of those great date movies that both men and women would be dying to go see. It's like, hey, I want to go see that new movie about guys who punch each other a lot. And the girl's like, I want to go see that movie with Patrick Swayze. He's dreamy.
He was in Dirty Dancing.
Not Ghost yet, but Dirty Dancing for sure.
Oh, yeah. He had broken with Dirty Dancing. And the cocaine-fueled 80s Hollywood just decided, this is our next action star.
So what they end up doing is crafting this story where the movie is very out in the open about the fact that men are dumber than women.
Yeah.
Like, they drive that home a lot. Like, women are the brains of the operation, and men just hit each other a lot. And the movie does really interesting things with its characters. Like, there's this really small character who tries to connect with Dalton early on. She's a waitress. And in this particular role, this is
Kathleen Wilhoit.
What was that?
That's the actress's name, Kathleen Wilhoit, yeah. Which I only know because she's the co-star with Charles Bronson in Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, but she's the type of character that you imagine they'd make a punchline out of. She's the dumb waitress.
Yeah.
Is how she's set up. And instead, they make her cool and end up having her sing with the Jeff Healey band and show her as talented and show her as, you know, being above the rabble that she hangs out
there's
with.
There's like, a lot of times where she's kind of a character from a different kind of movie.
Yeah.
She's really kind of the best friend from a rom-com.
She got lost on the back road to Jasper, and she's like, I was supposed to be in a different movie, but I got here.
I was supposed to be playing in a movie with Meg Ryan. Well, they have the same hair.
So what you have is a bunch of women who talk sense to a bunch of men who are morons and hit each other a lot.
That's true. Even though there's a great line in this movie of no one wins a fight, no one appeared to tell any of the characters in this movie that. Because fights will break out over a sneeze. A rough sneeze will set a place into a tither, and people will start getting knocked the fuck out. And one of the things I actually like about this movie is that Patrick Swayze, once again, from the Point Break point of view, is just zenning all over this fucking movie. Oh, yeah. To the point that he gets to, like, Miyagi levels of, like... Like, the opening shot where some guy's like, I want a shot at you. I want a shot at you, Dalton. Let's do this. And he's like, all right, let's go outside. And they all go outside, and these two guys are ready to fight Dalton, and he stands there like he's about to start a fight, and then just turns around and walks right back inside. Why? Because he did his job. He got those motherfuckers out of the bar, and he doesn't have to fight them. So he Miyagi's away. He adopts that same sort of Bodhi level of zen.
He has nothing to prove.
Yep.
And he doesn't give a shit.
Because he knows at all times. And, you know, not to, what's the opposite of burying the lead? Not to show our hand too early. But once again, when you are equipped with the knowledge that you could, with your bare hand, rip someone's throat out, you don't have to get into fights. You have nothing to prove.
Well, it's because he has that philosophy degree from NYU, which his doctor somehow saw in the medical records.
Do you not keep your degree and your major listed in your medical records?
Apparently you do.
Well, it was the 80s.
What Dalton actually reminds me of? There's a real dude in the world who's like one of those most interesting men in the world guys.
And I've seen his commercials.
And Dalton, no, like he is the most interesting Gen Xer in the world. He was, and I'm blanking on his name right now, but he's a guy who was in Nirvana. And he was in Nirvana for a short period of time. He paid money out of pocket to record Bleach. The guys didn't really like him that much. They kicked him out of the band.
Oh, it's the guy who was the drummer before Dave Grohl.
Yeah. And so they kick him out of the band. And so he's like listless. He doesn't know what to do. And then Soundgarden needs a guy on, I think, bass or something. And so Soundgarden hires him. And so he goes and he tours with Soundgarden for a year. And they kind of get sick of his shit. And they kick him out right before they take off. So here's this guy who was part of Nirvana and Soundgarden. Soundgarden, and he's been fired from both, and they both blow up and become two of the biggest bands in the world. And he's like, I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. So he's like, fuck it, I'm going to join the military. So he goes, he shaves his head, joins the military, and then someone on the base is watching some old videos of Nirvana, sees him playing, and goes, holy shit, I know that dude. He's in my platoon. Like, and so all of a sudden he gets the nickname Rockstar. So he can't go anywhere in the army now without everyone knowing that he used to play with Nirvana.
I know you.
And so he ends up joining the special forces and ends up becoming this special forces badass that's now not only known for as Rockstar for being in these bands, but is known for having been in some of the toughest, gnarliest fights in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then he comes back after leaving the military and goes to NYU to get a philosophy degree that he then uses to be a bartender in New York City. Like, this, and it's like, and I'm like, this is Dalton. This is Dalton's history. Like they haven't really laid out who Dalton is, but I want to believe that Dalton was like part of Steely Dan and like some other 70s super band, then went off to join the military, became a badass, and then ended up a bouncer somewhere in the fucking Midwest where he tears people's throats out and everybody's like, thought you'd be bigger.
Derek, I'm really sorry that we double booked you with our other guest tonight, Paul Harvey, but
and that's the other side of the story.
And now you know it, and knowing is half the battle.
But tell me that
no, that's Dalton. You have described Dalton's backstory that we don't get in this movie at all. We get a little bit. We know that he did go to prison. We know that he went to prison because he was in love with a woman who didn't tell him she was married and had to kill the husband in self-defense
by
ripping his fucking throat out. Because that is how
you have to set up our big climactic.
I kind of wish they hadn't done that. Like if that was a left field throat rip, which is now the name of my ska band, Left Field Throat Rip. That would be so, like, that would be an even more impressive thing where this movie, which is, I mean, it is violent, don't get me wrong, but all of a sudden it's like, he just tore that guy's throat out, guys. Guys, he just tore that guy's throat out.
I feel like had they done that, it would have been much more comical than badass.
I guess that's true.
By setting it up that we live in a universe where a bouncer can rip a guy's throat out in the middle of a fight,
yeah.
You don't question it because when it happens, you're like, oh, shit, he did it.
You're
I
right.
I saw him do it.
You're right, and by announcing it ahead of time, they are adhering to Chekhov's radical rules of throat ripping.
Yeah, you do not threaten to rip a man's throat out in the first act if you don't show it by the third act.
Yeah,
and we know he was in Albuquerque in 1979.
We do know that.
No, he's not wrong. Like
Wade said, he got hit by a bottle in Albuquerque in 1979, and Dalton's like, yeah, you got the worst of that one. So we know he was there. Yeah.
So
track down his progress.
Because the best part of this movie, the thing that is so amazing about this movie, is that as badass as Dalton is still junior to the most badass man in the world.
Yes.
Played by...
I believe...
Sam Elliott.
You're referring to Sam Elliott.
Who, by the way, does not yet have the patented Sam Elliott stash.
No. He does not have a mustache.
Instead...
No mustache.
Instead, this movie trades mustaches. Like last week had all those amazing mustaches. This week has the most glorious mullets to come out of the 80s.
Do you think the feathered hair is real? Like, we need to get in this discussion again. Okay, so the feathered, as long as the feathered hair is real.
Hair and lightning, I think, is what this movie has.
Yeah, Sam Elliott plays the character that was kind of the trainer, the guy who was the mentor to Dalton, who taught him everything he knows, and is himself working in a shitty dive bar where women are topless and people are fighting because it's 80s. And that's the thing that I love about the 80s is that in 80s movies, that kind of activity is not relegated just to strip clubs, just bars. If you go into a bar to get a drink, there will be a woman topless dancing on the bar. They're not necessarily strip joints. It's just anywhere that serves alcohol also has tits because 80s.
And any fight between two guys will spill out and the entire bar will start brawling. For no reason. Because they like fell on me and now I have to punch them.
It's like Wages of Fear. It's like driving nitroglycerin across a bridge and you're just like the slightest little jostle and the whole place erupts. Yeah, I just compared Roadhouse to Wages of Fear. That's a thing that happened on this episode.
Sorcerer, but you know.
Yeah,
same
I was
going to
say, really?
You're not
pulling out the
God,
American?
Going with the remake, you fucking heathens. But Sam Elliott is astounding in this movie. This is like, I had forgotten how much I love him in this movie. This might be, I know we talked about Tombstone last week, And that's a close second, but I think this might be my favorite Sam Elliott in any movie, because he is, first of all, I didn't know he was a fucking dreamboat. I only know him as the old grizzled cowboy.
Yeah, see, the thing is that if most people came to realize Sam Elliott, you know, when he had gotten into middle age. You didn't realize how sexy of a goddamn man he was, and here he's playing sexy dreamboat, last days of being a sexy dreamboat.
Yeah. There's a reason he got to marry Catherine Ross.
That is true.
And he also says, I'm just very disappointed in this movie, that one of his early lines is, I sure as hell ain't going to show you my dick. But this is the movie that more...
Wait, what?
Let's roll back
a second. No, we're going to gloss over. Gloss over. Is that nitro? Just put it back in the crate. Just put it back in the crate.
That's a sentence that just came out of your mouth, Brian.
Yep, and I'm not even going to point out the fact that you said it in the mouth. So, more than anything else, Roadhouse is the movie that shows just how tall Sam Elliott is. The man is a fucking giant.
Oh, yeah.
He's like lanky as Ichabod Crane. He looks like...
He was towering over Patrick Swayze.
No, he was towering over everybody. He looks like a cell phone tower grew up to be a cowboy.
Not Terry Funk.
Okay, the one exception, WWE legend Terry Funk.
A Texas wrestling legend. You live in Texas, you gotta know.
Yeah, but I know about as much of...
He lives in Texas, he's not from Texas.
I know as much about wrestling as I do about healthy eating, and I run a show called Junk Food Cinema, so that should kind of clear things up for you a little bit. So we've talked more about Swayze and Elliott than we have the actual plot of this movie.
Because, let's face it, there are two reasons to watch this movie, and it's Swayze and Elliott.
That's true. Yeah.
This is like, you don't sit down and watch Roadhouse and go, you know, I really want to watch a movie about an evil businessman destroying a small town.
I've always wanted to see Ben Gazzara play Al Capone in a shitty, tiny town in Missouri. Oh, Roadhouse has you covered.
It has you covered. Yeah, no, it's...
I've always wanted to see Ben Gazzara destroy the only thing that makes him money all the time.
Yeah, what is... Okay, can we talk about his ultimate plan here?
Okay, So, essentially, for those of you that haven't seen Roadhouse, you are sorely missing out. Like, this is a movie that I just revisited recently because I realized my wife had never seen it. And
Roadhouse.
I was like, oh my God, you've never seen Roadhouse. This needs to be a thing. And so we watched it, and she was like, holy shit, that was everything you promised it to be. Roadhouse sets out some pretty high fucking expectations, and it's one of those rare movies that actually meets every single one of them. And plot-wise, it's very simple. Dalton is brought to a small town to clean up a really shitty bar to turn it into a really shitty cliche of an 80s bar. tell me I'm wrong. Doesn't look like every douchebag club a drug deal goes down in a late 80s Schwarzenegger
in the quote-unquote drug trade that no one has to know how it works. It just works.
It just works.
Somehow there's a whole booming industry of this bar that's enough that people are fighting over their jobs and getting angry when they lose them in a town that's, what, Jasper, Missouri, is got to be like 400 people.
All of them are on coke.
Another junk food alum shows up in this in a very small role, John Doe.
John Doe
from X, the legendary punk band X, who is also the star of Roadside Prophets.
Gotcha.
The bartender.
Yes, that's the one that gets fired. Correct.
And then comes back to like whoop the shit out of Dalton, but not really.
Can try.
He's bitter because he no longer has his job where he gets to skim $150 a night from the till.
Right.
How much different is this movie if you switch Jeff Healey and John Doe?
To where John Doe's the head of the band.
John Doe and X are playing, and Jeff Healy's the blind bartender.
Well, who's skimming money and has to fight.
Before we get into all the other plot holes, why is it that one band got booked into this bar and apparently is the playing at the bar?
Well, I can answer that. I can answer that because it's Jasper fucking Missouri. What are they going to get? Nirvana? Hey, they just fired their drummer. I hear the really good things about them. This band out of Seattle, Nirvana, could come play the Double Deuce in Jasper, Missouri.
And it's not even for one night. They're like the house band. They've been
for like for the house 6 months.
They're locked into a Clark Gable contract. They're indentured fucking servants. Like, it's ridiculous. But actually, the opening band at the bar that Patrick Swayze is playing, I recognize the lead singer immediately.
Gypsy Kings?
No, it's Tito and the Tarantulas, like their lead singer.
A bunch of movies.
Well, it's he's like the right-hand man to the bad guy in Desperado.
Okay.
So immediately I was like, I've seen this guy in almost this exact same environment killing people. Where have I... Oh, Desperado is where I've seen it. Absolutely. So he goes to this bar in Jasper. Ben Gazzara has decided that he is, I guess, an evil gentrifier. I'm not really sure like how... He's kind of a gangster, but he's a legitimate gangster, and his whole thing is, I want to bring JCPenney to the small town of Jasper.
Well, yeah, and that he's what? Like forcing everybody to pay a percentage of their money.
Hey, yeah, 10% to the Jasper Improvement Society. Otherwise,
he wants to build strip malls.
Destroy you? I don't know.
Yeah.
He wants to build strip malls and malls and turn Jasper into a suburb.
It's like if you tried to bring Sam Walton up on RICO charges, it would be the Ben Gazzara story in this movie.
It's going to the fact that this is a Western, and this is the guy who owns the town and can do anything he wants, anytime he wants. From the very first moment we see him, where he's just weaving around the highway, just... He's such a badass that, you know, it doesn't matter if somebody hits him face on because he's rich and somehow that'll make him not die.
But yet you've hit the nail on the head, Derek, because you mentioned that one of his favorite activities is to destroy businesses he's extorting money from.
Yes.
In Jasper, Missouri, where there aren't a lot of businesses. He keeps talking about all these big companies, all these department stores that are coming to town because of him, but you don't see any of them. So ostensibly, his entire income comes from these small businesses that he spends the entire movie blowing up like it's a nuclear explosion.
Yeah, I mean, the freaking monster truck.
Which is an awesome lead-in to a very real point in this movie.
There's a guy in this movie, one of the henchmen, who, as his daily driver, has Bigfoot the monster truck.
Is it actually Bigfoot?
I don't know if it's Bigfoot, but he has a monster truck. As is like I'm going to go down to the Piggly Wiggly and get a gallon of milk and some bread in my giant monster truck.
I think the only way you should go to a Piggly Wiggly is in a fucking monster truck. I feel like that should be required.
Are we insult Piggly Wiggly now? Is that?
I don't know if we're insulting monster trucks or Piggly Wiggly, but somebody's getting it in the rear in that sentence, and I'm not really sure who. But so Dalton is.
Tell us again about that line that you really are disappointed with Sam Elliott.
The nitro is going back in the fucking crate. I don't know how many times I have to tell you not to play with the nitro. These are the wages of Roadhouse. Anyway, so Dalton resists working for Ben Gazzara. He immediately comes in and cleans house, gets rid of people who are skimming money, people who are selling drugs, people who are fucking underage girls in the storeroom because they want to have a regular Saturday night thing, which is where the feminism gets a little blurry in this movie, because it is still at its heart a macho as fuck 80s movie. Where dudes are just, you know, like, for example, letting people pay money to kiss their girlfriend's tits and encouraging them to table dance and, you know, encouraging them to show off their granny panty thongs, which is apparently a real thing in this movie.
Well, the lingerie was more high cut in the 80s.
Oh, it was super high cut.
Yeah, well, the thing about that, though, is that they've got a lot of shitty female characters in this movie hanging out with all the shitty male characters. Like, they're equal opportunity about the low rent people who he's getting rid of at this fucking bar.
That's true.
I gotta say, the dude humping the underage girl, that was some of the most realistic bad sex humping I've ever seen in a movie. Because he's just kind of like a dog on her leg.
Like, it's yeah.
It's,
but
it doesn't look like anybody's really enjoying that.
Especially not us.
You know what? We've just made this a more feminist movie because Derek's concern is that she's not enjoying the experience enough.
I don't think he's enjoying the experience.
But he thinks she's really well put together and let her get in because she had a Sears card.
Yeah, well, I mean, not everybody gets a Sears credit card.
Hey, there's only a Sears in this town because of Ben Gazzara. You genuflect and show some fucking respect. But we still never see these stores that apparently he's brought to Jasper.
Or he's bringing to Jasper.
Or yeah, that he is in the process of bringing to Jasper.
Yeah, I find it interesting that the movie's like equal opportunity about how shitty the low rent people are. And then everyone else is, you know, like when we get to the doctor character, who's, I forget what her name is.
Doc.
Doc.
Literally, that's what they call her throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, no, but her real name, like...
Oh, the actress's name? Yeah, like Kelly Lynch.
Kelly Lynch. She's got a very... There's a famous story. She's married to, like, a producer now or something who's friends with Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And every time Roadhouse comes on television, Bill Murray, no matter what time it is, will call him up and go, hey,
call Mitch Glazer.
TV and I'm watching Patrick Swayze fuck your wife.
See, now, the way I heard that was that anytime any of the Murray brothers... Like, it could be Brian Doyle.
Hey, Mitch, it's Brian Doyle. I'm watching Roadhouse, and your wife's getting railed. Call me. I need work.
Getting that phone call, like, just at 3 in the morning, and it's Bill Murray, and it's like, Bill.
Yeah, I know exactly what that would be. Hey, Mitch, so I'm watching TV, and your wife's getting railed, so she's got that going for her. Patrick Swayze. Okay, bye. It's exactly what that phone call is. It's like, 3 in the morning, Bill. It's 3 in the fucking morning. Stop calling me.
I get it. My wife was in a movie with Patrick Swayze, and they have a love scene. I get it. But apparently they still do it.
Yeah, I was going to watch funny. I was gonna watch Quick Change on cable, Bill, but oh, it's not on again. It's never on, Bill. Hang up the phone.
I don't have Starzplex.
I can't watch it.
That ninth channel down on the free Starz preview weekend.
By the way, Quick Change is a great movie. It's a movie, again, that no one has seen. It doesn't make it a bad movie. If this podcast should enlighten you to anything, it's that just because a movie hasn't been seen doesn't mean it's bad.
Yeah.
Speaking of, is it bad? I have a very sincere question that I have never, ever asked on this show. Is Roadhouse a bad movie?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No.
Because I was racking my brain like... Okay, this has been listed in, like, the top 100 bad movies of all time, most enjoyable bad movies, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, I'm watching this movie, with like, under a microscope. And, yeah, there's some cheesy elements. Of course, the bad humping and so on and so forth, and, the preponderance of tits everywhere and every step. I'm as surprised there's not a scene where he goes to the library to check out a book, and there's just, like, well, the librarian's just letting him hang out. But
the look, especially in the beginning... of a bad 80s movies. It just has a lot of hallmarks, whether they be that made for TV cinematography, the music bed that's just seems made to sell a soundtrack, the fact that you can even see the product placement where, like, he's going to sew his arm up and there's a bottle of Chaps cologne right there.
Oh, I missed that. Wow.
I watched this movie twice in like the past week.
Well, this is something that I actually didn't know until this viewing, but you know, you mentioned the cinematography. You know who shot this movie?
Somebody good, I'm sure.
Dean Cundey shot this fucking movie. Dean, Jurassic Park, pretty much all of the greatest John Carpenter movies, fucking some of the biggest movies of all time. Dean Cundey shot Roadhouse. By the way, I also learned this week that he was an uncredited cinematographer on The Human Tornado, and that made me very happy.
Of course that would make you very happy.
Yes. So, and produced, of course, by Joel Silver.
Yeah.
Well, which explains that, why it feels so cocaine-fueled at times.
But that's
because it's Joel Silver, you know, coming home in a body bag, man.
Yeah, the thing about Roadhouse, the reason I will defend it, I will defend that it's not a bad movie. It's a movie that plays to the cheap seats. Like, this movie knows exactly what it is. I don't think it's a bad movie because it hits everything that it aims for, and you're never laughing at the movie for the wrong reasons.
This is true.
Like, the movie, you're always, like, you're not laughing at him ripping the throat out. You're not finding that stupid or goofy or over the top.
No, that's cringeworthy.
It's cringeworthy, and you're loving it, and you're eating it up with a spoon, and you're enjoying it. This movie knows exactly what it is, and it delivers on all cylinders. Like, there is not a point in this movie where you're like, yeah, okay, this is, you got to look past this. No, Roadhouse delivers entertainment at every turn, and it's developing characters, and it's getting you to care about them. We have one of the things we haven't gotten into yet is, you know, I keep mentioning that this is a Top Gun knockoff. It is beat for beat fucking Top Gun, right down to the fact that Sam Elliott is Goose.
Yep.
And when Sam Elliott gets killed,
oh my God, it broke my heart.
Just out of the blue, out of the blue, knife in the chest.
Well, it's because Ben Gazzara pulls a fucking Joker in The Dark Knight, is like, I'm gonna kill one of them. You get to decide.
Yeah.
I'm gonna flip a coin.
Where do you think that was borrowed from? Do you think maybe that whole that whole scene from The Dark Knight was kind of maybe lifted from fucking Roadhouse.
If you are playing along at home, we have now on this show purported that inspirations for The Dark Knight include Roadhouse and Tom Waits. So put all of those things together.
I don't disagree.
Much like Roadhouse, we make no apologies for that.
This would totally make sense, if especially given the amount of TV that these guys, that the Nolans must watch, because they have a lot of TV actors just like in these little cameos. Anthony Michael Hall, when he was on Dead Zone, just shows up in a Dark Knight movie, or somebody from Battlestar Galactica shows up in a Dark Knight movie. And I think the Nolans were watching a lot of late night TV, and they might have come across Roadhouse on Movies for Guys Who Love Movies.
And if... Wow. Is that Spike TV?
That was TNT.
TNT.
Movies for Guys Who Love Movies.
I've referenced
that.
It was that.
This and Die Hard, like, on a loop.
Yeah, and
which share a lot of things
Beastmaster.
In common.
And Beastmaster.
And Warriors.
And yeah. The rest of the redneck trilogy of Patrick Swayze, Next of Kin, and Black Dog.
Oh my God, Next of Kin is fucking drink, folks, because we are covering the hell out
Liam
of Next
Neeson
of Kin.
As a deep southerner? Fuck we're doing Next of Kin eventually. But we couldn't do, I've been wanting to do Next of Kin, but I knew we couldn't do Next of Kin until we did Roadhouse. And I needed to revisit Roadhouse, and by revisiting it, showing it to my wife, I was just like, we're fucking covering this movie now. It has been too long.
Yeah.
You know, if you go down this road, this leads to Black Dog.
All roads lead to Black Dog.
We actually need to do a Meatloaf episode, because Meatloaf has made so much great junk food.
Which is a great sentence.
It is.
Meatloaf has made much great junk
because
food.
Because you know what? We'll talk about Black Dog. We also got to talk about Leap of Faith. That's take another drink, because that Leap of Faith is an episode that's one of my favorite films that nobody remembers exists. Steve Martin is a fucking preacher, and Meatloaf is the bus driver for this revival,
and it is a movie I've seen.
That movie's a lot of fucking fun.
And the money in that movie made more sense than the money in this movie.
That's true. But bringing it back to Roadhouse, Stargrove, we're back.
Stargrove.
Speaking of, by the way, I'm so glad you mentioned that. This movie, the reason I am surprised it took us this long is because when we covered Tango and Cash a little over a year ago back in the summer, we talked about the fact that Gabriel Cash was a role that was offered first, not to Kurt Russell, but in fact to Patrick Swayze, who turned down the role so that he could do Roadhouse, one of the greatest macho lateral moves of all time, I feel.
Roadhouse became a classic.
And Roadhouse had the better team behind it. It's got Joel Silver, coked as he may have been, has made some of the greatest movies of the era. Yeah.
I mean, just because they're cocaine insane in the membrane doesn't mean they're bad.
Okay. Yeah. I'm gonna Sophie's choice you.
Uh-oh.
You can only have one team up in your life.
I'm gonna kill one of them.
You can only have one team up.
I'm gonna flip a coin.
You can have Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone, or you can have Sam Elliott and Patrick.
Oh,
Swayze.
Fuck you!
Like,
a thousand times, fuck you! I can't. How dare you?
There's one moment in Roadhouse that says why I do Patrick Swayze and Sam Elliott, and they're sitting in the car. They're about at the hospital, about to pick up Doc. And Sam Elliott turns his head, sees Doc coming out, and just looks at him and goes, I knew it. God damn it. And that's all. It explains their relationship.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
It explains their relationship so well. And that's the thing, is that's what happens when you put someone like Sam Elliott in a movie as this, you know, Sam Elliott is one of the great supporting actors for manly movies. Like, there's another movie, every time we talk about Sam Elliott, I keep meaning to bring this up, but there's a great movie that, okay, the movie's not great, the movie is good. It's called We Were Soldiers.
Oh, yes.
And We Were Soldiers is a good movie with Mel Gibson, but the guy playing the sergeant of his unit is fucking Sam Elliott. And there it has one of my favorite macho moments of all time, in which Sam Elliott is marching through the jungle towards, like, just walking at a brisk pace through the jungle towards these Viet Cong who are shooting at him. And a bullet streaks by him and hits a leaf on a tree right next to him, and he looks down and then looks up and is like, oh no, you didn't, and then starts charging even harder, like walking, and you're like, this is the most badass man. He's like, he's pissed because someone shot near him.
Did you just fire at me, half pint?
And that's the thing, is that you always buy that kind of performance from Sam Elliott. He has this dark, brooding machismo. He's like that uncle you have that you never wanted to get in a fist fight with because you knew he'd kick the shit out of you.
He's also brimming with honor. Like, in We Were Soldiers, yeah. I would imagine he's the one guy in the platoon calling the Viet Cong Charles. You know what I mean? Like, he's the one guy with class outfit.
And that's the thing.
As tough as he is.
Everyone in line. That's the thing. He's the classy macho guy. And that's what's so interesting about this movie and why I don't think it's bad. Because as much as it's playing to the cheap seats, it's classy when it's playing to the cheap seats. It's not selling that there's honor in being a badass. It's selling that there's honor in being a badass and not having to prove yourself.
Exactly.
Until you need to.
Be nice until it's time to not be nice.
Exactly. I can't believe it took this long before one of us quoted that.
I read that scene is now used in police training to break up the sort of monotony of it. And they'll show that scene and they'll go, he's not wrong.
Wow, heavy social commentary alert. I think that would actually solve a lot of problems that we're having in this country if more police officers were shown that moment where he's like, rule number one, take it outside. Always take it outside. Nothing in the bar. Two, what was two? Do you remember two?
See, this sounds like something Art Acevedo probably actually does.
Right?
We have, for those of you that don't live in Austin, we have this amazing police chief here that took a very angry, thuggish police force and turned them into a very good, well-run, very well-liked police force, known as one of the most well-liked police forces in the country. And this one guy did it by turning it around and kind of being Dalton. Like now every time I see Art Acevedo on TV, I'm going to be thinking of him as Dalton all grown up. Like, that's just the be nice.
Well,
like,
that's rule two. Rule one is never underestimate your opponent, expect the unexpected, which again sounds like fucking Miyagi.
Yeah.
And the second rule is take it outside, never start anything start anything inside the bar unless it's absolutely necessary. And three is be nice. Somebody gets in your face, calls you a cocksucker, be nice.
Oh, and let's talk about one of the other things about him and his zen that makes this movie so good. This movie's really smart about how it unravels Dalton in terms of storytelling. Because we see Dalton roll into town, in his nice car. You know, he throws somebody the keys to his car and he's leaving. And you're like, what the fuck?
There was a homeless guy the keys to his car.
Homeless guy gets the car. He goes in. He pulls a sheet off. This really super nice, I'm thinking BMW or Mercedes. Like, it is an 80s boner car. Like, that is what this is.
That homeless guy just had the time of his life.
He drives that car to Jasper. Then he puts it in the place where he settles in the farm. He covers it up, and then he goes to a car lot and buys a shitty, shitty car.
Yeah.
And he looks down, and he sees this weird, like, headlight cover, and he goes, Do those work? And he's like, yeah, they do. And he's like, I'll take it. And you're like, what the fuck is this? And then they let you know that this is the car he buys to drive to work, because this car is going to be smashed by assholes every night. He just knows it.
And he buys the flip open headlights so nobody can smash his headlights.
So he gets it.
Because the very
the
next scene after he buys that car, you see him at a junkyard buying four new wheels with four new tires on them, as if he expected. Yep.
And he puts them all in the trunk because he knows it's going to happen. And that's what
the price of doing business.
That's one of the things about that I love about this movie and why I object to anyone calling it bad, because this movie tells a very real story about a very real character being, you know, in a classic 80s movie sense. But they develop it, they set it all up, and they execute it perfectly. They hit every target they aim at. They develop Dalton as exactly the guy they want to be. Dalton makes entire sense in this cinematic universe. Sam Elliott makes total sense in the cinematic universe. By the time we're halfway through the movie, we buy why everyone in the bar scene has heard of these two dudes. Like, it seems weird that anyone would have heard of a bouncer in a bar, like, from eight states over. But when you get into this movie, you're like, oh, I know why people like he. I understand why Dalton is the Snake Plissken of the bar scene.
Yeah.
I understand. Because that is, by the way, it's totally. That's
he's
heavily from fucking Escape.
He's Snake's nephew, Jake Plissken.
I thought you were dead.
I thought you'd be bigger.
I thought you would be bigger. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody thinks he would be bigger, and the joke just keeps coming time and again because everyone knows who this dude is and the legends that they have told about this guy.
Everybody fucking knows him,
and everybody expects that he's a fucking mountain of a man because who else could do this shit? And that's why everybody then underestimates him, and then he kicks the shit out of them or kicks the shit out of someone in front of them that they go, oh yeah, no, you're the boss.
Look,
boss.
I may have spent a moment or two in a bar in my life. That may have happened.
It may have happened this week.
It may. Don't worry about it. The thing is, even as much time at my lowest point in my life that I spent in bars, I didn't know, like, there were no legendary bouncers. Like, that wasn't a thing. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't a guy that you just knew. Like,
you know who just checked your ID, son?
No, I don't, because it's the aughts. And that's not a thing that exists anymore. It was at the time.
Working at a bar as a bouncer is not a career. In the Roadhouse cinematic universe, it is a career path.
Yes.
It is something you decide you're going to do. It's not something you do for a few years while you're in college or until you can figure out something better.
Or no. Until you can get a sweet bodyguard job for a celebrity.
Yeah, but I just imagine that, like, at the time, that Sally Struthers commercial where it's like, you could get a job in drafting, you know, dental assistance, VCR repair, cooler and bartender training. It's like, what now? It's an actual career? All right. Thanks, Sally Struthers. I will jump on that.
I want to go to the ITT tech that will teach me how to rip out a throat.
Right?
That's the class I want to see.
Okay, class.
I think you have to go to NYU for that.
Basically, what we're going to do today.
That's the philosophy course at NYU.
We are going to rip out a man's throat, and then after that, snacks. But you know what's crazy about that is the throat rip isn't even the end of the movie. Well, that's how fucking macho this movie is.
So here's the thing I want to talk about is the structure of the end, because that's where Roadhouse deviates from most other films.
Right.
And it's interesting in how they go about it, because the end of this film, the climax of his arc, the arc that they've set the story up for, is the fight on the beach under the moonlight where he rips out a guy's throat.
It's very romantic.
And it is... Dude, it's fucking Kill Bill. Like, it is the scene they lay out in Kill Bill, swords dueling by moonlight on the beach. Like, that's what that fight is. It is very much a samurai fight of two fucking badasses laying it out and beating the shit out of each other.
I had not seen this film until I watched it for this podcast. Since, I don't know, it might have been since I've seen the entire film beginning to end since it was in the theater. And I remember the throat rip as being the end of the movie.
Yeah. No, it's because it's not, because it is in terms of his arc, but then we still have to deal with the bad guy. But what this movie does, I want to tie into a movie we talked about a few weeks ago. What this movie does is he goes to confront the bad guy, but he won't kill. He doesn't want to kill. Like, he had to kill the last guy.
Yeah.
Like, that guy had to go down. He didn't want to do it, but this guy murdered his friend, and he's...
Also told him that he used to fuck guys like him in prison, which, I'm sorry, like...
That is one of those great, awful lines in cinema.
It's like, this guy's got one of two agendas, and I don't want to be a part of either of them. So, like,
it is,
time
that
to rip
is one
a
of those really, really weird lines that a lot of people are like, wait, did he just... Oh, mm-hmm. No, yeah, he said it. And you know what? And the thing is what's interesting about that line is that guy's such a bad hombre, he doesn't give a shit. His masculinity is not threatened that fact.
Yeah.
He thinks that's fucking masculine.
That's not a line that he said, you know, like... I used to eat pieces of shit. You eat pieces of shit. Ha ha ha.
No, yeah, not like he didn't think about it.
No, I used to sodomize young men, people like you, in prison.
Yeah, and you know what?
Because it's about dominance.
Yeah,
he would give a whole lecture.
Dominance. Like, the way it's set up, it's really interesting. Like, especially in the 80s, that's not played up as a homophobic line. Like, that's not, you'd expect that in the 80s, because the 80s was all about making the homophobic jokes and getting away with it and it being a big, you know, fag. You know, that was a common thing in 80s movies. And here it's like, no, this is being used to show how bad fucking ass this guy is. So then they fight, He rips the throat out, and then we get the climax where we go to confront the big baddie, and he won't kill him. But, you know, he's confronting him because Doc doesn't want him to be that guy. No. Doc, he wants Doc. Doc wants him, but Doc wants fucking Zen Master Dalton. Doesn't want fucking off-the-hook action movie Dalton.
Scary throat ripper Dalton scares the living shit out of
And her. This, again, is one of the things I feel is wonderful about how weirdly redneck feminist this movie is, because Dalton gives into that because he's like, oh no, Doc is right. I shouldn't be this guy. I need to be the good, gentle guy. I need to be nice. I'm going to listen to her. Like, it's not, the woman is right. And so as a result, he won't kill the bad guy. So what happens? The town elders from fucking Doc Hollywood
have
all gotten together and they all shoot one at a time, like the fuck. And again, and this comes straight out of Shakespeare. It's the fucking scene with Caesar where everyone has to shank Caesar. Everyone and all the town elders shoot this guy so that they're all in it together. And they don't actually say that, but they all do it so that they know if any of us ever talks about this, if any of us go down for this, it's all of us. So
man,
this is a town secret. We are killing the guy that was choking our town.
You went a lot more steamed because when I watched this ending, which is actually, like, as much as I love the throat rip, of course, the ending of this movie that you're describing is the far more interesting part. But it's because to me it felt like a Walking Tall ending. It felt like a Joe Don Baker 70s revenge, but revenge with a social conscience type ending, where it's like these guys have just fucking had enough of this oppression, and they are each, like you said, just taking a shot at him and putting him down, and he keeps getting back up with every shot, which is incredible because, like, 60-year-old Ben Gazzara, who's about the size of Joe Pesci, just won't fucking stay down from one gunshot blast.
He is this tiny little Italian or Jewish,
we're not really sure,
Chicago South Side monk from Russia.
It's Rasputin. He just will not fucking stay down. And meanwhile, like, Joel Silver's in the background like,
wait, shoot him again. Oh my god, that's awesome. Terry, give me more cocaine.
I'm doing cocaine with Terry Funk. He's gonna let me hit him with a steel chair. You guys,
Terry, barbed wire, let's do the barbed wire thing. Terry,
like, that's just Joel Silver.
Foley.
Where's
Foley? Terry!
That's on every film production. That's what I assume Joel Silver's doing in the background. And speaking of, one of the things that I think, again, when we're talking about, you know, movies that are playing to the cheap seats versus legitimately bad movies, this movie goes for it on every level. We talked about Dean Cundey shooting it. We talked about Joel Silver producing it. Yep. We didn't talk about this, but the fight scenes in this movie are great.
Yes.
They're very minimalist. There's not a lot of spectacular, over-the-top fight choreography, but it looks very real. It looks very genuine because an actual fucking kickboxer trained everybody and trained Patrick Swayze to a degree that he actually tried to talk Patrick Swayze into pursuing a career in kickboxing because he thought he had such a knack for it. And when you watch these fight scenes, when you watch that throat rip scene, it's two guys on a beach. That's it.
Yeah.
They don't even need to dress it up with a location. It's just two guys on the bank of a fucking lake.
Here's the point in the episode where, since we're talking about Patrick Swayze, we have to talk about Patrick Swayze's origins. Because that's one of the interesting things about Swayze is he got started as an athlete, not an actor. He got hired in his first film, a little film called Skate Town USA.
Oh my God, take a shot.
He was a dancer.
He was a professional roller skater. He was a dancer, but he was a national champion roller skater.
Okay.
Yeah.
Derek's face is like...
Like artistic, maybe, I guess. A roller boogie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he
no, not artistic. Like, did you not hear him say Skate Town USA? It's the opposite of artistic.
Derek, living in Des Moines, has not been here for the various screenings of Skate Town, so he's one of those people...
I have seen it, but I have not seen it with a group of... Wacky Drunk People.
You haven't seen it in a theater projected.
Okay. Wacky Drunk People was actually the prototype name for this podcast, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, so here's this guy who, you know, has this complete athletic control over his body and who has this charisma and can act. And so, yeah, I assume that he fucking took to kickboxing like a duck in fucking water.
They don't.
That
yeah.
is, that does not surprise. Like the way he was in Dirty Dancing, the way he was, because he fucking like I know those of you who have not been listening to the show long enough to have heard me rant on Skate Town before. He
this must be your first episode. Welcome.
He steals the fucking show in Skate Town. He's playing the villain, and every time he goes out to perform, you wonder immediately why the villain is cheating, because he's clearly outskating
yeah.
every other person in this movie, way skating circles around the hero. Like, of course the hero
literally
is being,
at one point.
Of course the hero's manager is Scott Baio. This guy isn't good enough to get anyone better than Scott Baio. This guy is not fucking Patrick Swayze. And so Swayze is just, he brings that physicality, that magnificence, again, into this movie, where you cannot take your eyes off him. He nope. is, whatever he is doing, like when he's doing topless Tai Chi in the farmyard.
Oh, so hard.
It's...
What?
What? Wait, what?
Put Nitro? It back.
Nitro is going back in the box?
In the crate. In the crate. In that in one. Crate? Stack wow. the crates.
Wow, Brian. Tie the,
what?
Wow.
What? Like it's are, Patrick Swayze, look, guys. Look, I'm sorry. I'm not,
look.
It's not a bad thing.
No.
It's just... The man,
let's go to prison with Patrick Swayze, guys. That's
this,
all I'm saying.
This movie, embrace I honestly believe feelings. That this movie is like the peak of his physicality. Like, the thing is just the way his body is sculpted from a bodybuilding aspect is just magnificent. You know, the way he performs in these fight scenes, like this final scene on the beach, just you're mesmerized by the it's minimalist. It's yeah. it's simplicity, but it's so good. It's so, and he's so magnetic. Like, this movie is the movie, the reason why this movie has its place in the pantheon of, you know, cheesy 80s action is because you can't watch this movie and not fall in love with it or fall in love with him.
True.
If you never thought that Patrick, if you think Patrick Swayze was some kind of jokey 80s star, you have not sat and watched Roadhouse recently, because
true
watching
story.
That, you're like, of course this guy's a fucking movie star. This guy is the most interesting. Oh, Sam Elliott. Sam Elliott is
the most interesting man in the world.
But the thing is you see these two guys together yeah. and you're like, there's no one in the world that is going to be and still, by the way, Brian, you still haven't decided which
I'm not gonna Sophie's choice. I'm not gonna. I'm gonna vote for go for Jill
I'll
Stein.
It. I'll do it.
Dude, the answer is Jill
you know
Stein.
What? The reason I brought it up, I go Swayze Elliott.
Only because I think the two of like either one of them on their sickest day where they still have like the flu and they're stumbling into set still has more on-screen charisma than Stallone. So I think that's probably the trump card there. But you combine Swayze's physicality, the fact that he's well-trained, the fact that he took to kickboxing, you combine that with the fact that Dean Cundey shoots this movie mm-hmm. and you are resisting a lot of edits. These fight sequences don't have a lot of edits so that you don't get the impression that they're trying to fool you, that these actors can do this. It just feels very much like a genuine fight. And it's not perfect. It's not always polished. Like, there's a moment in a fight sequence, this is a very real thing that happens in this very real movie, where someone pole vaults off a fat guy.
That is a thing that happens. Yes.
And it's like people falling on tables, like beers getting spilled on extras. It's like there's a very like out of control feeling to it, but at the same
like it was choreographed by, you know, James Best and Burt Reynolds characters from Hooper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it feels like they made the fight scenes, because they still feel they're very much the brawls and fights, despite the fact that they're using a little bit of martial artsy kickboxing, whatever. They feel like Western fight scenes rather than new, improved, post Matrixy what we're used to fight scenes. They feel like old cowboy Western.
Well, and that's because scenes. And that leads into the fact that so many of the character names in this movie are taken from Western heroes.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
I mean, Wade Garrett is Pat Garrett. Like John Wesley Hardin is where Ben Gazzara gets his name, who is one of the most notorious killers of the West. Kelly Lynch's character's name Doc, which is a reference to fucking Doc Holliday.
By the way, to tie this into last week, John Wesley Hardin spent time in prison with Johnny Ringo, and that's how they ended up knowing
Whoa.
Each other.
And it's directed by a guy named Rowdy. Roadhouse is directed by a guy who, honest to shit... R-O-W-D-Y is his first name.
Which, you know, we'll put behind Rowdy Roddy Piper and Savage Steve Holland.
this is true. Yeah, we kind of have to.
Is there a better name than Savage Steve Holland out there? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. But what are we hearing when we're watching these fight sequences? We're watching the emotional moments of this movie. We're hearing a score by Michael Kamen, who did fucking... That's why all of the emotional moments in this movie sound like Lethal Weapon, and all the action sequences sound like Die Hard, because it's the same fucking guy.
Well, yeah, and because those are both Joel Silver movies.
So you have this fucking dream team.
Yeah, no, this is the era that action movies became what we think of as 80s action movies, mm-hmm. are actually late 80s action movies that are Joel Silver movies. Joel Silver, the reason why... He's a notorious character in Hollywood, so notorious that Warner Brothers got so sick of his shit, they canceled a 30-picture deal they had with him and just paid him out a ton of money to have him off the lot and go away. Like, there are a lot of people who didn't like him. Shane Black loves him because he's always been on the Shane Black train.
Terry, I want to do another line. I'm going to have you chew these thumbtacks. Terry, put these thumbtacks in your mouth.
But Joel Silver, through Roadhouse, Lethal Weapon, and fucking Die Hard, fucking made the movies that we hold as the greatest of this era and the epitome of what we think of with 80s action films. Mm-hmm. Like, when you think of 80s action films, what you're not really thinking of the early 80s, mid-80s stuff.
No, people forget.
That's where all the great genre is.
People forget that Die Hard came out in 1988.
Yeah.
One of the seminal movies of the decade came out right about the time it was ending.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, absolutely.
But Silver, like, this is a Silver film, but unlike a cop who gets trapped in a building or a pair of cops who are breaking up this international drug ring, it's about a fucking brawler, you know, cooler, working in a club, cleaning a club up and turning it into a club, and then he has to clean up the whole town because the villain won't let this stand. And that's what's interesting about it is it. You brought up Walking Tall, and I think Walking Tall is a great comparison for this because it really is one of those movies where the villain really is his own undoing. If the villain just kind of left this guy alone and said, you know what, fuck this Dalton guy, let him run his club the way he is, he'll go away eventually. Had the villain been smart and called up some other club owner and said, look, I'm going to give you $50,000 and I want you to take that $50,000 and hire Dalton away for twice what he's getting paid here. The guy's a mercenary. He'll go out to your club, have him work there for 6 months and then let him loose.
Yeah.
Like, that's what a smart villain would have done. Like, that's the smart villain would have just paid him. Dalton would have been, all right, you know what? I cleaned up your club. I'm out of here. He's gone. And then he owns the town again. But no.
Or just not burned down all the businesses that were paying him.
Gotta make room for the Macy's. I gotta make room for the Macy's. It's like, you are insane. You're a crazy person.
Literally gone after him and targeted him the entire.
Yeah.
Like maybe not called his kung fu goon in to fight him after his girlfriend got done doing her striptease on the stage.
Yeah, what is that?
A modern dance mixed with striptease, whatever the hell.
It was odd. That was odd.
A very, very, very Joel Silver moment. Like, of all the...
Joel, are you dating this girl? Why is she so naked in this movie?
That is a legitimate question to ask.
That's why I asked it.
I'm very curious. Like, when you watch Roadhouse, it's like, which topless woman did Joel bring in?
All of them.
Wait, are you insinuating that there was cocaine in Hollywood in the 80s?
I'm insinuating that every building on the set of Roadhouse was constructed of at least 50% cocaine. I'm insinuating that this set was like the tasting room in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory where you could snort everything.
Stories, and not necessarily about Roadhouse, but about other productions, similar time.
Like Skate Town USA, actually.
Skate Town USA.
That's the one that got Maureen McCormick back on coke.
Teen Wolf. Other movies that had...
I love that killed you, Brian.
Set her back on the coke train.
Yes.
They used to have... You know, you've heard of craft services. You know,
yeah, they'd have a bowl of cookie.
They'd have
coke services,
egg sandwiches, granola bars, some soda pops, and a mirror full of cocaine.
I have heard stories from people who worked on the set of Can't Stop the Music that the village people had Hellman's jars of it. That one of the jobs of a
PA, if you're gonna bring out the Hellman's, you're bringing out the best
Hellman's jars of cocaine into a single Hellman's jar. Like, this era was coke fuel.
I'm saying is that the pool tables in the Double Deuce are not the only place where you can find eight balls. That's what I'm saying about a Joel Silver production. This movie is so fucking good that I am incensed by the idea that it's made all these lists of like the best bad movies or the most enjoyable bad movies. I don't see this as a bad movie. And the only other question I have is Dalton really just Bodie? Like, Bodie gets away at the end of Point Break, and we don't know what happens to him.
No, Dalton isn't Bodie.
Are you sure, though? Because he shows up in town. He's got that same weird, like, Zen mentality. He is only taking payment in cash. He's staying at the house of some weird farmer that he can pay in cash, and like, so he can remain completely off the grid.
Yeah, but
Bodie had that adrenaline junkie thing going that Dalton never would.
But
Bodie
maybe
Prop could have been a pupil. And of Dalton.
And Bodie also wouldn't have a problem with this guy running the town the way he is.
Maybe so, but
he just wouldn't give a damn.
Maybe Bodie learned something. Maybe Bodie found out that he, in fact, was living too much to get radical and adopted an entirely new... Because the philosophy that Dalton apparently majored in was so nondescript. It was like, I don't know, whatever, looking for God and trying to find yourself and yada yada.
I will prove it to you right now. I will ask you the question.
Scientific.
That will science you.
Junk food science. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Do you think Sam Elliott's character would have taken Bodie under his wing?
No,
he would.
No, that's more of a Gary Busey move. Now that I think about it.
Gary Busey.
Hey, you see a little dog around here? Hey, Joel, you got any more of that coke left? Is Terry eating thumbtacks again? Tell me Terry's eating thumbtacks again.
I'm starting to get a headache again. Give me more cocaine.
Hey, you want to see me do some motorcycle tricks? No, we don't. Okay, Gary, just get away from the motorcycle, Gary.
Cocaine is not a good therapy for a traumatic brain injury.
Should we take the Hellman's jar away from him? No, that's actually just mayonnaise. He's just spooning mayonnaise into his giant mouth. He's spooning mayonnaise into his giant maw.
Yeah, so that's Roadhouse. I love this movie. I think it is a perfect example of a great. It is a great version of a lot of the movies that we love that are flawed. Like, this is not a movie like you could call, like, as we've done, call out flaws in the villain's plan, but they're not plot holes. They're like, what's wrong with this villain?
They're
like,
just they're moments that could have used more. But yeah, there's nothing. There's nothing that is unconnected about this movie. There's no point where it doesn't work because of poor construction. It's just it could have had more. And much like the Roadhouse itself, that building stands up. Like, that building is not poorly built, but when you walk inside of it, it's just like you could have done more, but there's nothing wrong with the construction of the actual building. That's kind of how this movie works.
Why did you clean it up by putting up so much particle board?
Well, we had to do something to distract from all the eyeballs on the floor and all the eight balls on the bar. Hey, speaking of the bar, the greatest tragedy of this movie is that we didn't get the over 2 hour long cut that would have included more scenes of Keith David. Keith David did one scene of this fucking movie.
Yeah, he had the background of like two others. But he has like one line. Yeah,
whiskey's running low.
I'm actually bitter at myself that we have not mentioned Keith David yet.
By the way, whiskey's running low.
He replaced John Doe behind the bar with Keith David and don't even show us.
In a movie full of amazing hand-to-hand brutal fight sequences, Keith David has one line and then he's gone. Unforgivable. In fact, unforgivable.
He does have the single greatest hand-to-hand fight scene of the 80s.
That's true. But the fact that he's
another
so,
movie we have not done yet. Why have we not done
bullshit.
They Live?
That is as much bullshit as Keith David only having one scene in this movie. So much so that from now on, when we mention an actor who is great but only in one scene of a movie, Whiskey's Running Low is going to be how we tag that scene. Because Whiskey's Running Low is his only line in this fucking movie. And that is a travesty.
Can I buy you guys a drink? Guess not.
Speaking of travesties, this episode is over, which means we got to do the junk food pairing. And I feel like we've talked about movies that pair well with beer a lot. We've talked about drinking a lot of beer while watching things like Straight Down USA. That's fine. This movie demands that you walk into the seediest dive bar in your neighborhood and you order yourself a frosty mug of beer. I mean a real Roadhouse beer. All the better if the place you go to... from the tap, and you walk up to the bar and you say, give me a beer. You don't even fucking specify, because that's a movie thing that drives me crazy, but I kind of want to secretly try it in real life, where you walk up to the bartender and you just say, give me a beer, and they just know what the hell you're talking about, because they apparently only have one on tap, and they will pour it into a frosty mug, and if you're really lucky, there will be a bowl of peanuts at the bar, and somebody will be fighting.
A bowl of, wait, is this one of those Samuel A. didn't show you his peanuts thing again?
No, this is me just wanting to go to Texas Roadhouse because I like cheap steak, apparently. I don't know.
Texas Roadhouse or Logan's Roadhouse?
It's called Texas Roadhouse, and we're talking about the movie Roadhouse. I've got to go to Texas Roadhouse. Although it feels very sacrilegious to go to a place called Texas Roadhouse when you actually live in Texas. Like, I remember when I lived in...
You should just call it Roadhouse.
You should just call it Roadhouse.
Order fries in France.
Or nuts in Brazil.
It's not like the Texas Roadhouse is limited to Texas. They're in every suburb.
I know. I grew up in Indiana where it was like, oh, we're going to Texas Roadhouse. We're getting an authentic taste of Texas. No, we weren't. That wasn't authentic Texas. That's like when you go into the America Grill in Japan and Japanese people are trying to tell you what America's like. It's just Marilyn Monroe and Elvis and French fries and that's it. That's kind of what Texas Roadhouse is in creating the authentic Texas experience. But what I'm talking about is going to a dive bar, getting a frosty mug of beer from the tap, just saying you want a beer, and watching people fight over God knows what, because that is the perfect pairing for this movie. And remember, at all times, no matter what's going on, if they call you a cocksucker, be nice. Always be nice.
My pick this week would probably be cigarettes and donuts. Like that's like the waking up to cigarettes and donuts scene is like the perfect kind of terror. Like
the screenwriter diet.
It is the screenwriter diet.
You have to pick up the donut, look at it, and go, ugh, and then light a cigarette and drink some coffee.
Yeah,
as if this donut's so bad for my health. Coffee and cigarette.
Yeah. I don't need donuts anymore. They're bad for you.
Worth the set.
Is that powdered sugar? Is that powdered sugar?
Drop. What was that? My mullet won't be as big and feathery if I do.
Dude,
this
his
donut.
Mullet is magnificent.
Oh my god, that
movie.
Hair!
We haven't talked enough about the mullets.
I want that hair.
Even Sam Elliott's mullet is glorious.
Oh my god, I want.
This isn't a mullet. It's too long in front. It's just long hair.
It's just gorgeous, is what it is.
Yeah, but he made it work.
It's a mane. It's a lion's mane.
It's an Elliot mane.
Oh, I want Elliot mane. Like, that hair is ridiculous. Anyway, speaking of ridiculous, this is the end of Junk Food Cinema. I really hope you've enjoyed yourself, and I really hope if you haven't seen Roadhouse that you will head on out to the Roadhouse and have yourself a real good time, because, again, a much better movie than you remember, for sure. If you want to hear more things that are much better than they have any right to be, check out our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Derek, thank you so much for joining us on this episode.
This was awesome. I had a great time.
Where can people find you?
Yeah, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at dman, DMANN11 at Twitter.
At
or
Twitter.
Sleeping on my couch.
Or sleeping on Cargill's couch.
Whatever. You know, things happen.
Things do happen. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me with my dog breathing into the microphone right now. I apologize if you
Yeah, we're going to pretend that's the dog and not you thinking about Sam Elliott's mane.
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. And if you really like the show, I can't say it enough, please go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become a patron. That's how we keep the lights on here at Junk Food HQ. I mean, I feel like I've said be nice too much. So polar bear fell on
be
me.
Be nice.
Be nice.